Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. So today I'm happy to have Cole Bunzel on the line today, and he is a PhD candidate in Near Eastern Studies at Princeton, and his research focuses on religious history of Saudi Arabia, and I know he does travel to the country, which is very, very interesting, since a lot of our guests haven't been over there. They've been to other places in the Middle East. But he also held, before his PhD studies, he also held government jobs and think tank jobs, and he is a current contributor to the website Jihadica, and he has a number of articles there, great research topics, so I highly recommend our listeners to see some of his work on Jihadica. But today we're going to talk about actually two articles that he's written recently that kind of coincide and blend together. The first one was titled The Caliphate Scholar at Arms, and that was posted on the Jihadica website on July 9th. And then the second one, which was actually posted yesterday, which was July 23rd, is titled Al-Qaeda's Quasi-Caliph, The Recasting of Mullah Omar. So please check these out if you want to read the in-depth research, but we're going to kind of talk about some of the issues that come up in these articles in this talk today. So first of all, welcome to the show, Cole.
Hi, Chelsea. Thanks for having me.
So why don't we kind of start off with a little bit of the first article. This is one, the Caliph Scholar at Arms, and you really follow a lot of a character by the name of Turki al-Bin Ali. So I was wondering if you could explain who this person is to our listeners.
Sure, yeah. Turki al-Bin Ali is a religious scholar who's part of the Jihadi Salafi movement, who is currently living within the domain of the Islamic State or Caliphate, and is considered to be one of the most important religious authorities for the Islamic State. And what's interesting is that for people who have been following online jihadism for some time, they've seen in the name Turki al-Bin Ali has been a name, but not a very big name. Bigger has been a pseudonym that he used to use, which was Abu Humam al-Athari. And Turki al-Bin Ali wrote hundreds, probably, of fatwas, religious judgments, that were issued on the most popular jihadi website, which is owned by the Jordanian jihadi ideologue Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi. And that website is basically tawheed.ws. And so he was very well-known in jihadi circles, and when the caliphate basically extended itself, or not the caliphate, but the Islamic State at the time extended itself into Syria last year, a lot of jihadi scholars were opposed to this move, as they have been opposed to the declaration of the caliphate last month. But Abu Humam al-Athari was a big proponent of the caliphate, and he became probably the biggest online authority, religious authority, supporting the caliphate. As for his country of origin, we know that he's Bahraini. Very recently, only in the last few months, has it come to light exactly who he is, and that, in fact, the pseudonym Abu Humam al-Athari is, in fact, a man named Turki al-Bin Ali. What's interesting about him, not only is that he is from Bahrain, but he's only 29 years old. He was born in September 1984, and there are a number of very hagiographical biographies about him. They even have photocopies of all of his certificates from teachers in different schools. They're very much trying to play up his kind of his aura as a religious authority. And he is, it seems, a pretty talented speaker and writer, and he has a prodigious memory. The biographies that there are, they describe his background in Bahrain, where he had an early religious education, and his subsequent studies in Dubai, where he was arrested for more or less being a jihadi and deported back to Bahrain. Thereafter, he studied in Lebanon and took degrees in Islamic studies. And more important, though, than these official studies were his kind of impersonal or rather impersonal connections with the larger Salafi and jihadi Salafi scholarly networks. So in Lebanon, for example, he met with and studied with a well-known Salafi authority named Zuhair al-Shawish, and he has a certificate authenticating his religious knowledge from that man. And he also studied and worked with Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, who is the Jordanian ideologue that I mentioned earlier, who is in the jihadi movement writ large, probably the most well-known and most respected authority, religious authority, that is. As for where he lives now, I don't know exactly his movements. He has a Twitter account or a Twitter handle, at Turki al-Bin Ali, which I link to in my Jihadica piece about him. And there were reports that he arrived in the Islamic State, or in what was then Syria, in northern Syria, in February 2014, and there were pictures of him. And since then, it's also been clear that he did a lecture tour in Mosul. But other than that, since the declaration of the caliphate, his movements and his activities have been much more muted.
And you mentioned his Twitter account, which this is sort of this new world of jihadis on social media. We're seeing this more and more, and it's seeming to be a really prominent way, especially for the Islamic State currently, ISIS, to promote their word, get their message across to the world. How active is Bin Ali on Twitter?
Well, until a few weeks ago, he was quite active, very active. He would promote a lot of his writings. He was writing a whole lot at the time, particularly over the last 7 months. And every time that he wrote something, it would go up on his Twitter, on his Twitter feed, and there would be sometimes hundreds of people retweeting it. Now, before Twitter became kind of the preserve of, or the favorite place for jihadi distribution of ideological material, the preserve of jihadi production was a number of websites. One of them was al-Maqdisi's website. Then there were a few forums, al-Qaeda forums. These websites still exist, but they've become less important in the larger scheme of things. So, for example, when in April 2013, last year, when the Islamic State declared that it was expanding to Syria to become ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Sham, soon after that, Turki al-Bin Ali, writing under a pseudonym, put up a long article basically defending Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, and telling all Muslims that they ought to give bay'ah, or some kind of pledge of allegiance, to him. And that work would appear on al-Maqdisi's website. There's now been a big falling out between al-Maqdisi and Bin Ali, and no longer does there seem to be a need for somebody to have a website like al-Maqdisi's. He can just use Twitter. So this is a big change.
Very interesting. And in your article, you allude to this very strong relationship, at least at the starting, with, I guess you could almost call him Bin Ali's teacher, al-Maqdisi.
Certainly. Yeah,
and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this relationship, at least their past relationship, and then how it's gone from being quite close and his teacher pretty much praising Bin Ali for his wonderful religious work and insight, and then going from that to this, where they're pretty much done with each other.
Oh, yeah, they are very much not friends anymore.
Exactly.
So it's quite dramatic, even, the way that they write about it. In his Refutation of al-Maqdisi, Turki al-Bin Ali writes that this is the only work I've ever written that I haven't been happy to write. Yes. Very sad. But the relationship, as far as I can understand, from the materials at hand, is this. Turki al-Bin Ali studied at some point in the early 2000s with al-Maqdisi, And in 2009, he received what's called in Arabic an ijaza, or some kind of authentication of his, some kind of credentialing for him to teach al-Maqdisi's works, which is typical in Islamic intellectual history, to give ijazas. So in this ijaza, al-Maqdisi writes that, I wrote in my piece, if a sheikh has the right to take pride in any of his students, I am proud of this beloved brother. And since then, also in 2009, the relationship was close, because we know that when al-Maqdisi set up what is called, or what he called, a Sharia council on his website, which was kind of a question and answer forum, mm-hmm. for people who were interested in, you know, the jihadi worldview, to pose questions and get answers about any number of questions, Abu Humam al-Athari and about 11 other scholars were selected by al-Maqdisi to be members of the Sharia Council, which was established in 2009. And over the years, some of these members were killed, some of them disappeared, we don't know. But at the end, in about 2012, there were only two left who were still writing, and one of them was Turki al-Bin Ali, using a pseudonym. So he was very close. And all of this comes out in the refutation that Bin Ali wrote of al-Maqdisi, which is essentially a refutation of the refutation that al-Maqdisi wrote of the Islamic State. And I can talk about that. I probably should. Huh?
Yeah, no, I think that would be great, because, as you said, there's been this huge falling out between the two of them, and it's very much of an ideological falling out. And probably, I'm sure there's some personal rift, too.
But
yes. You really go into that deeply in the article, and it's quite interesting. So I'm sure our listeners would love to hear more about that.
Right. A lot of it is very personal. What happened is that, beginning in December 2013, January 2014, there were a lot of disputes between the Islamic State and other jihad-fighting groups in Syria. And there were a number of initiatives by unaffiliated sheikhs, such as a man named Al-Muhaisini, who is based in Syria, but who is a Saudi. He had an initiative to reach a kind of reconciliation between the different fighting forces in Syria, Islamic fighting forces. And basically, a number of initiatives were launched, and they were basically kind of turned down by the Islamic State. And the reasoning that the Islamic State has for not wanting to, you know, have any kind of arbitration with other groups when there is a dispute is because it sees itself, as it did see itself at the time, as a sovereign state with its own courts and its own judges. And therefore, if anyone wanted to kind of submit to God's rule, they had to do it through the legitimate legal tools of the Islamic State itself. And this is something that Bin Ali made very clear. And al-Maqdisi was another one of the sheikhs who was trying at the time, and over about, it seems like a period of several months, from January 2014 on, while he was in prison, to launch one of these initiatives for reconciliation. And he was trying to reach out to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of al-Qaeda, and as well to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS. And his contact for speaking with ISIS officials was his former student, Turki al-Bin Ali. And when basically Turki al-Bin Ali in these emails tells Maqdisi, look, you have it all wrong. We can't have reconciliation like this because we are our own state, al-Maqdisi is furious with him. And eventually, al-Maqdisi decides to publish a refutation of the Islamic State, and he publishes, along with it, the text of a lot of the emails between himself and Turki al-Bin Ali. And this infuriates Turki al-Bin Ali, because, and not only does he quote him, he also adds grammatical errors into some of his writing. So this is where it can become personal. Now, there's an effort, perhaps it's not Maqdisi, perhaps it's, you know, somebody who typed it up on his website, but there's an effort clearly to kind of demean the religious learning of Turki ibn Ali, who is, I should emphasize, only 29 years old. So after this happens, Turki ibn Ali, he writes his own refutation of the sheikh. He says, "Well, Maqdisi is very rude, and he kept calling me their vaunted religious scholar." And ibn Ali says, "Look, I'm not their only religious scholar, and I'm not the most important." So he does actually say that he is not the most important religious scholar who is part of the Islamic State. But as far from what I can tell of what al-Maqdisi and other prominent jihadi ideologues are writing, he really is. And it does seem that it might just be false modesty on his part. The Islamic State and its propaganda, essentially, does publicize a lot of his work.
And this is quite interesting because you do allude to that he is only 29. And for such a young person to gain a fairly prominent religious position, or should we say potential religious position, since it's not written in stone and publicized that he is the religious figure for the Islamic State. But let's talk about the significance of this, because he's quite young, and mm-hmm. I'm sure the older religious elders are probably not too fond of this.
Yeah, that is a whole lot of that comes out in what Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi wrote in his refutation of the Islamic State. He views a lot of their members and their religious authorities as kind of young upstarts who don't respect their elders. And he even writes, "Take heed of seniority, al-istaqiyya." And this is something that Turki ibn Ali was eager to refute in his refutation. He said, in one refutation he wrote of another jihadi sheikh, Abu Qatada al-Filistini, he even suggested that it was his age that had led him to be weak on jihad. And so there is a real generational divide that seems to be opening up between some of the more established figures of the jihadi ideological movement and the younger ones. And it makes sense for someone like Turki ibn Ali to be out in front as almost the leader of this younger cadre of jihadi intellectuals, because he is so young, and also because he is so young, he has alluded in his writings to the difficulties that he has had trying to be a religious authority given his age. So when he was imprisoned in, I think it was Bahrain, several years ago, he wrote an essay about this. He was visited by a very prominent Syrian, Saudi-based religious authority. His name is Adnan al-Ar'ur. He's just reviled by the jihadi community, this man. And he was visited by him, and al-Ar'ur tried to convince him not to be a jihadi, essentially. And he told bin Ali, "Look, you're such a young kid, like, and you're giving people religious, religious writings, and this is nonsense." And in response, bin Ali writes an essay about how in Islamic jurisprudence there is no rule for how young one or how old one has to be before issuing such rulings. So this seems to be a kind of an ongoing theme in his life, this kind of fight with asbaqiyya or seniority. On the other hand, in some of his writings, bin Ali has exhibited a great deal of deference to al-Maqdisi. He's written a number of entire book-length monographs just in praise of his sheikh al-Maqdisi. And he wrote in his most recent refutation that when there was a dispute between al-Maqdisi and Abu Musa al-Zarqawi back almost 9-8 years ago now, that bin Ali kept mum, even though he disagreed with his sheikh, out of respect for him. So there seems to be now a trend that's opening up where the younger scholars who support ISIS are going to basically separate from their older colleagues.
That's quite significant with this new Islamic State that has been created and its potential continuation or fall. You do talk about Bin Ali writing the first monograph in support of Baghdadi's announcement on his expansion of the Emirate in Syria. And I was wondering if you could explain a little bit the significance of this monograph and its importance for Baghdadi and the Islamic State.
Right. So the monograph that he wrote soon after, I think it was a month or two after the announcement of the Islamic State's expansion into Syria, it was called Extend Your Hands and Give Bay'ah Allegiance to Baghdadi. And what was significant about it at the time was that, for me at least, it showed that, oh, this is really somebody, this man, Abu Humam al-Athari, who I thought he was at the time, is very close to the Islamic State. He has details about the life of Baghdadi, about his education, his different positions, and the jihadi movements that no one had revealed before. And he even revealed or brought to light his full genealogy that traces his descent back to the Prophet Muhammad and to his tribe of Quraysh. And this is significant because Baghdadi was being portrayed as a claimant to the caliphate or the future caliphate. And Bin Ali says this explicitly: we hope to see our sheikh sitting upon the throne of the caliphate. And this really long genealogical list of names is significant because in traditional Islamic law, to become caliph, you have to meet a certain number of qualifications, one of which is proving your descent from the Prophet Muhammad's tribe of Quraysh. Throughout Islamic history, this was largely ignored on the grounds of necessity or weakness, but it is something that is there. So the idea of showcasing his genealogical descent from Quraysh was a big deal. And ever since, when jihadis are uploading biographies of Baghdadi, they often are just taking word for word what Bin Ali wrote in this essay, and often not even attributing it to him. So a lot of our information on Baghdadi comes from him. And that is also true for our information about the official spokesman of the Islamic State. His name is Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, for whom Baghdadi penned a biography only a few weeks ago. So he's something of the court biographer of the Islamic State.
And with him providing all of this information, is it assumed that he's quite close with these two figures in the Islamic State, or could this be something that he is doing from afar and gaining information in one way or another?
Well, he may not have a direct line of communication to the actual leadership. I don't have any evidence that he does, though when al-Muqtasi, his former sheikh, was trying to interface with the Islamic State leadership so that he could help reach a reconciliation in Syria with other fighting groups, he did use Bin Ali as his intermediary. And in one of the emails, I remember Bin Ali says, okay, I will check with, I'll check with the leadership. So he clearly has a line. How direct, I don't know, but he is certainly plugged into the leadership.
And I kind of want to start bringing this talk and blending in your second paper that was just recently published about Al-Qaeda's quasi-caliph and the recasting of Mullah Omar, because, as I said, blending these two talks together and what's been happening, so Baghdadi makes his great announcement of creating this Islamic State and bringing back the caliphate, and they assume that all the jihadis are going to be excited and pledge allegiance to the Islamic State, which that's still to be seen. Seem like the announcement was as welcomed as Islamic State might have thought it would have been.
Well, actually, I don't know about that.
Okay.
I think that...
Oh, okay, please talk.
Well, I think that this is, despite there being... they're engaging in insane levels of violence, this is a group that's actually very pragmatic and thinks very strategically about what it does. I think that the timing, for example, of the what are called the conquests of Western Iraq, it took place, you know, just a month before it would be Ramadan and this caliphate declaration could be made. It seems to me that a lot of this is orchestrated and well thought out, and that they probably knew that they weren't going to get the whole jihadi community on their side, but they were going to try because they had nothing to lose really from it. So it's a war, but and they haven't won it yet. But there are a number of people who seem to be switching sides, so it could potentially work out in their favor.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. I mean, only time will tell, of course.
Right, Thomas Heghammer has a very interesting essay about this issue. I can't remember where I saw it online, but basically where he discusses ISIS's or the Islamic State's strategic thinking and the Caliphate Declaration and goes into a number of scenarios that were probably in their mind. And it's very worth reading.
So looking at Al-Qaeda's reaction to the announcement of the Islamic State, as you, in your own words, in your second paper that I've already quoted the title and so forth, they almost create a proposition of a counter-caliphate of sorts. So let's discuss this and what Al-Qaeda's reaction to Baghdadi's announcement was.
Right. So people expected that Al-Qaeda would quickly come out with some kind of statement rejecting the declaration of the caliphate, which has not yet happened. Clearly, they reject it. There's been a longstanding dispute between them. The leadership has engaged in debates online that you can read. They don't like each other. But Al-Qaeda, instead of coming out and denouncing the caliphate, has instead done something rather odd and ambiguous, which is making a few or suggesting in two ways that Mullah Omar, or Mullah Muhammad Omar, who is the leader of the Taliban since 1996, is possibly the real caliphal figure in the Islamic world, and that he is the figure that we should be considering caliph, not Baghdadi. And the way that Al-Qaeda seems to have been kind of planting this suggestion or this seed of doubt about Baghdadi is that, well, two things. One was the release of a video last week, which is an old video of Osama bin Laden from, I think, June 2001, where most of the video, it's 70 minutes long. It's not very interesting. There's not much new there. But there is one question that Osama is asked, and that is whether or not he has bay'ah, whether that is a pledge of allegiance or a contract of rule with Mullah Omar. And he's asked in particular, what is the nature of this bay'ah? And bin Laden says that this is the supreme bay'ah, and what it implies is that all Muslims must owe allegiance or bay'ah to Mullah Omar as the commander of the believers, as Amir al-Mu'mineen, the traditional title of caliphs. And he goes on to dispute the idea that Mullah Omar, because he's not from the Prophet's tribe of Quraysh, that he doesn't qualify to be caliph. So now Al-Qaeda put this up on the internet without any explanation. And however, the pro-Islamic State jihadis picked up on it immediately and got very upset because they thought, look, Al-Qaeda is trying to tell us that they have a different caliph, that Mullah Omar is caliph. This is nonsense. And then about a week later, or no, just a few days later, Al-Qaeda releases a new newsletter called An-Nafir, and the first lines of the newsletter reaffirm the bay'ah of Al-Qaeda to Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, as commander of the believers. Now, they don't say that he's caliph, but there is some ambiguity here that I believe is being fostered.
Mm-hmm. And so looking at this idea of Mullah Omar as a caliph, potentially, and then Baghdadi as a caliph, and you mentioned earlier, of course, that bin Ali has made sure that he can track Baghdadi's heritage to the Quraysh, the Prophet's tribe. However, as you mentioned, Mulla Omar, that can't be done. How much of a breaking point is this for potential people on the outside making a decision on this?
Well, there are a number of things. It's not just the matter of descent from Quraysh. That is a big factor. There are a number of things that would restrict Mulla Omar's appeal as caliph or potential caliph. The matter of descent from Quraysh is important. That's something that, in their reputations, a number of jihadis have been saying and talking about, quoting religious authorities, medieval religious authorities, who say that the caliph must be from Quraysh, no exceptions. But then there is this longstanding precedent in Islamic history where the caliph, for example, the Ottoman caliphs didn't descend from Quraysh, that this precedent was that if the caliph was not of Quraysh, then that could be justified on the basis of necessity. Or, look, he was the best possible option at the time, and it's better to stick with the caliph we have than to try and seek the ideal, because that could lead to war and division, and that would be terrible. So, on the other hand, there is, I think, a great deal of symbolism about the idea of descent from the Quraysh. It's certainly something that the Islamic State and its media plays up on. It plays up enormously. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, we are reminded every time his name comes up that he is al-Qurashi, al-Hashimi, that is, he is from Quraysh, from the Prophet's descendant also of the Prophet's grandson, Hussein. And these are, this, I think, resonates with a lot of people, particularly in the jihadi movement, who are looking for legitimacy. And they have textual legitimacy for the idea that Quraysh is the preserve of the caliphate. And then there's this symbolic legitimacy, and it's being played up to a great degree. The other things that would prevent Mulla Omar from being a potential caliphate for those who are of the, from the perspective of those who are of the jihadi persuasion, is that he fails to meet two other qualifications. One of these is not kind of showing enmity or hostility to the unbelievers. So when the Taliban was an actual government, he, as head of state, had relations with the United Nations, with relations with Iran, which jihadis tend to consider an unbelieving state, and they tend to consider the United Nations as an illegitimate forum, a forum of polytheism with absolutely no legitimacy. And Mulla Omar participates in this, or he did. And the second thing is that he is not, because he's from the Taliban, and the Taliban have a different kind of religious heritage there in Afghanistan and in the Pakistan area, there are differences in theology between those who are in the jihadi, the Arab jihadi movement, and those who are part of the Taliban. So the jihadis ascribe or are part of the Salafi theology, whereas those members of the Taliban will tend to be of the Maturidi persuasion. This gets kind of nitty-gritty and detailed, but it's something that jihadis have been writing about for a long time, and it's caused a lot of division. For example, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, we know, would not fight along with, when he was in Afghanistan, would not fight with other Afghans or with Arabs who were cooperating with Afghans, because they didn't espouse the proper theology, the oneness of God, and other things like that.
So looking at this potential play into Mulla Omar being a caliph by Al-Qaeda, what are the main reasonings behind this, as you call it, counter-caliphate?
Right. Well, I try to emphasize that it's something of a quasi-caliphate, because what Al-Qaeda seems to be doing is fostering ambiguity over the idea of Mullah Omar being a caliph in waiting, but not really quite caliph, which is the position that Baghdadi used to hold when he was the Amir al-Mu'mineen, the commander of the believers, which is the traditional title of caliphs. But at the same time, it wasn't clear that he was trying to be the caliph, the commander of all believers, because he didn't tell the whole world, as he only started to last month, the whole Islamic world, that every Muslim in the Islamic world owes him bay'ah, or allegiance. So what Al-Qaeda is doing, it seems to me, is kind of two things. They're fostering ambiguity because, for one, the idea of a caliphate, they have realized, is really quite popular. And a lot of the younger generation of jihadis has found this appealing, and Al-Qaeda probably thinks that, and, you know, how can we can't just come out and denounce the caliphate, that makes us look bad, but we can perhaps put up somebody else who we can sort of describe in caliphal language, and you know, what that does is, you know, gives us a sort of counter caliphate, but it also detracts from the legitimacy of Baghdadi himself, because he is seen as a possible usurper. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a very important jihadi ideologue who is presumably from Mauritania, who recently wrote a fatwa espousing just this view, that in fact Baghdadi is an usurper, and that since 1996 Mullah Omar has been the caliph in everything but name, and we should be treating him as caliph. And this has caused shockwaves in the pro-jihadi intellectual circles online, the pro-Islamic State jihadi circles online, because they find the idea of Mullah Omar having been caliph to just be absurd. And it's also a threat.
So looking at this as all of this as a whole, what are the important meanings in the sense of now we're really seeing division starting to happen even more than we did previously in the previous number of months, years, between Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, and if I can go out on a limb, I can say these are two very prominent militant groups. So what is the importance of this rift, and potentially what could it mean for the future of both of these groups?
Right. Well, I should probably say at first that I am kind of interested in these divisions for their own sake. So my first order of business isn't generally thinking what are the implications. But it does seem that the battle lines, so to speak, between two different jihadi factions or wings have been drawn, and they've become a lot more fixed. Particularly, there's a caliphate now, and people have to make decisions. Are you with us or are you against us? And that means that the divisions are much less likely to be amicably kind of resolved as they might have been in the past. For example, when there was an issue, there was a dispute between Al-Muqtasi and Zarqawi, and Zarqawi died. That was kind of the end of that dispute. This is a dispute that doesn't seem to have an end in sight. Not until, you know, either the caliphate is over or everyone in Al-Qaeda is killed.
And so do you see this almost as, before I ask this question, there's this idea of jihad in general, the jihad, you hear that term used a lot.
Right.
But does this mean that we have two separate jihads happening?
There are two factions of jihadis who basically claim the mantle to the trend, as they like to call it, or the current of jihadi Salafism. These are their words. And they have very different focuses. The one is very much more focused on so-called near enemy, on fighting jihad in the Middle East, And that's the caliphate and Al-Qaeda being sort of displaced from the Middle East, being in wherever they are. And they usually say Khorasan, which is basically the AFPAC area. Their strategic emphasis since bin Laden has been on the far enemy or attacking Europe and America. So it does seem like there are two strategic focuses that are distinct. But that doesn't mean that there isn't any overlap between them and that they both don't share the same objectives. They just seem to have different emphases in terms of strategy, different strategies, really.
Anyways, thank you so much for being on the show, Cole. And please, for our listeners, you can check out more of his work on Jihadica. And we will post the link to that so our listeners can view your work. But thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about this really, really interesting subject.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye.